Hey there, nice to have you back on the podcast with us. Before we get to my guests this week, I want to thank everybody for leaving some nice comments on iTunes. If you haven't done so, please do. Always helps to have that out there. And please send the links around to your friends. We want to keep building our following, which is going great. I want to remind people, March 23rd and 24th, I'm going to be headlining at Bananas Comedy Club in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey. So if you can make it there, please do, Bananas Comedy Club. And March 28th to the 31st, I am going to be at the House of Comedy in Bloomington, Minnesota, in the mall. And you can go online for tickets. That's March 28th to 31st in Bloomington, Minnesota, the House of Comedy. And my guest this week is world famous volleyball player, pro volleyball player, Gabby Reese, who is a trailblazer in beach volleyball for women and just an amazing athlete. She's a mom. She's a best-selling author. And we had a really cool conversation about a lot of different stuff, including this really intense underwater workout regimen that she and her husband, world-class surfer Laird Hamilton, do. So enjoy that. And please check me out on the road. And please leave some nice comments. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. My guest this week is someone that I've watched on TV and have been amazed at what she's been able to do over the years as a pro volleyball player and someone that's sort of person that's created new paths for women in professional sports, a model, a mom, a wife, Gabby Reese. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And what I was amazed about was in sort of reading up on you a little bit was that in 11th grade, you came to Florida from St. Thomas. And basically that seemed to be, if I have this wrong, tell me, when you started to really get involved in sports. And then within a year you had a scholarship for sports to Florida State. That's pretty amazing to me.
Well, I think also it was a different time, you know, it was a little, I would say probably less competitive that way, but yeah, I mean, I dabbled a little bit in volleyball in the Caribbean, but it wasn't as organized. And then when I moved to Florida, I was 15 and 6'3", which, you know, that doesn't hurt. Yeah. And I was fortunate enough to get, you know, I was seen by a few of the right people and was fortunate enough to be offered some scholarships and decided that that was a really interesting and unknown path for me. And turned out to be one of the best things I ever did.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of, when I think of pro volleyball now and it's in the Olympics and all, I really feel like it sort of stands on your shoulders. Like how hard was that to take that from a sport that people were somewhat familiar with to more of a mainstream sport, especially on the female side?
Really everything, especially as you kind of go around the block a few times, you start to realize about timing. And I think I just happened to be at the right time at the right place.
Right.
And there were other athletes, for example, Karch Karai and Sinjin Smith and Randy Stoklas were playing at that exact time. And then right behind me was Kerry Walsh and Misty May to sort of continue that, you know, the forward movement of that.
So yeah.
I think I just was really fortunate to not only be in that generation the right time, but also then I was supported by outside companies like Nike and some other ones that also helped communicate the sport outside of it, volleyball, because volleyball, you know, beach volleyball, it's really a tricky dance. And even to this day, where trying to transcend your lane a little bit, you know, you need help. So yeah. I was fortunate that way.
When you say transcend your lane, meaning beyond sort of the core group of fans and devotees, but sort of to the masses?
Well, and just even to touch the masses a little, because you know, listen, it's like, I mean, my husband Laird is a surfer, right?
And yeah.
So very well versed in niche sports. So beach volleyball, you know, to some degree, skateboarding, BMX, in a way skateboarding might bubble over a little bit further. But it's understanding, hey, we're dealing with something that is never going to be European football or the NFL or the NBA, but how do we take up as much space or maximize the lane that we're in And if that means from time to time being able to go into mainstream and just to be like, you know, we're over here kind of thing. So you're always calibrating between your reality. Like, you know, sometimes we get self-absorbed in things and we think our stuff is more important than it really is.
Right.
And so in a way to navigate it correctly is actually to go, well, really, what is my place in this grand scheme if I'm objective? And then how do I maximize that versus in my small world, I'm so self-important or important that I think everyone else cares and they don't. So you're, you know, you're sort of mixing and matching between the two places, because if you really want to try to be effective, you do have to stand back from time to time.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I'm a comedian and perform and act and all, and it's the same feeling. Like, you get so, my wife reminds me, you know, the world isn't thinking about you as much as you are. And she's right. But I think what's amazing is that you brought another sport to the forefront while having to be as good at your sport as Michael Jordan or LeBron James has to be at theirs. And that's not easy, you know, taking nothing away from them or from of great baseball players. Their sport was already pretty established, you know, and you had an extra challenge, which I thought was amazing. And it's funny because I was watching the Olympics, the Winter Olympics, and, you know, I really love watching the snowboarding stuff and how cool that is and how athletic it is. And like, what, maybe 15 years ago, it wasn't even around in the Olympics. And I think life is evolutionary and sports should be evolutionary. And there shouldn't just be the four or five traditional sports that we watch. So I think it's great that beach volleyball, along with the surfers like your husband and the snowboarders and all of that, have kind of expanded our horizons as sports fans.
Yeah, I think what I do like about that, and for example, snowboarding, to your point, it probably barely existed 30 years ago. It's, you know, they turned sideways and it was like mono ski to whoa. Okay. And I think what I like about it is it also, beyond the competitive realm, it sort of allows people to have a creative approach. So if they want to, you know, like snowboarders, for example, if they want a free ride, or they want to, like guys that want to go and be dropped off at the top of a peak in Alaska, that's one type of snowboarding. And then you've got people who are doing, you know, half pipe. And so even within that, they get to have a creative expression. And maybe for me personally, what sport is, it isn't just winning and losing. It's sort of committing yourself to something. It's the discipline. It's the hard work. It's also, you know, my husband and I are very different. For him, it is a really, it is an artistic outlet. And so I think what I really appreciate about that is it also could encourage people who maybe they know, hey, I can't get enough people together to play football or even baseball, but you know, that sport over there, that sort of, I could do a version of that, and that looks like that would feel good to me. So I think it's just technology and different types of equipment have allowed this other kind of explosion. And also, let's face it, more free time, right? Like if we were all working in the fields and trying to get dinner on the table, we wouldn't really have time to explore like riding a piece of a plank down a mountain.
Right. Yeah.
You know, listen, the sun is up. I need to figure out how to navigate getting food or what have you. So it's also the fact that we have more time.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. You used the word artistic regarding your husband, who's a world-class surfer, and, you know, sort of reading an article and watching some stuff on you guys and sort of the way you train and the differences in the way you train and your husband, and you kind of, there's one shot of him, he's inside with you, I think you're doing yoga or something, and say, look at us, we got Laird, it was a bad surf day or something, and you got him inside doing land workout, and he tends to be more artistically, I think you said in one quote, you're like, he'll go until he can't go anymore, whereas you kind of have a structure to it. And I was really fascinated by that. And I think my listeners would be, explain sort of the differences in how you approach training.
Well, first of all, let's, and you know, I was listening to these biologists talking about people want symmetry to equal equality. Well, I feel like I'm a very strong female, but I live with a very strong male, and I see firsthand for 22 years some differences.
Yeah.
One being my husband's Laird sort of saying, like, I can't afford to go until I can't go anymore because, you know, kids are going to get up in the morning and they need breakfast and what have you. And right. And if we were living in a time that he was hunting, he would go until he couldn't go.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, so just based on that. And also I have a belief that he can take a little bit more of a physical pounding than I can. And I intuitively know that. So I am more measured and more cautious. And he's very within his capabilities. He's really cautious, but his ability to kind of push it is significantly different. And you're also talking about a person that has developed that as a skill, right? Like putting themselves in very heavy situations. So I think the other side of that is part of artistic expression is he's out in nature. He's out with Mother Nature. He's out in an energy that actually he's never going to be stronger than.
Right. Right.
And I think he thrives on that because he goes, okay, I can surrender all of my energy, all of my drive, everything I've got, I can push into this and it can take it and say, okay, cool. What else do you have? And so I think I don't, for me personally, and I know women that do, have that innate drive. If we went on a bike ride, for example, and you said, hey, we're going to go on this ride. He wouldn't ask you, well, where are we going or how far is it? He'd just start going and go. And me, I'd say, okay, well, I know how much fuel I probably have in the tank. So I'm going to at least find out kind of how far we're going so that I can pace myself.
Right.
So he'll just go until it's
done. It's fun. It's funny. Like, it's like if I had a training partner in a gym, you know, you use that person to push you. His training partner, I guess, is nature, right? I guess in a way, and sort of just,
I mean, you have both. You have the one on land because, you know, if you're more prepared and you're stronger,
right,
that you'll be for longer and for the years to come. But the humbling thing about nature is it sort of says, hey, you can give me your very best shot. And you could give me your energy, your anger, whatever power you think you have, and no problem. And so I think there's something really important because not only is it all consuming and all present, but it does create perspective. So, you know, in an athlete like Laird, and there's many like him, I think in a way they're quite humble because they're really connected to understanding that really we truly are all grains of sand. And the more talented they are, capable of standing on a higher peak or in a bigger wave, they know that even more than someone like me who doesn't even get as close to that power because they see it.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. You had an interesting thought that I read and I wanted you to elaborate on a little bit. And I think it was when you were talking about sort of moving to Florida, you know, you were 6'3" in 11th grade and something. And you said this phrase, your body was a way out. And yeah. I was wondering what that meant. I was fascinated by that.
Everybody has their story I didn't always live with my parents, and my father died when I was 5. And then my mom sort of out of a need had to sort of leave me to be raised by a couple for a while. And then I moved back in with her. But my family certainly couldn't have afforded to send me to college. And I've always said, you know, everybody has low cards and high cards. And so it was very challenging as a teenager, if you're 6 feet at 12 and whatever, to understand, yes, but that's also a high card. That's an ace you can play.
Right.
And so sports was a way, and my height was obviously connected to this, for me to navigate a path for myself that I otherwise wouldn't have, or it certainly wouldn't have been as easy, or people wouldn't have been as eager to help me. You know, like a coach kind of wants to help you if you're 6'3".
Right, right, right.
So it was understanding that this is a tool, and it doesn't mean to manipulate it, but it's to understand, like, hey,
no, yeah, exactly. I mean, yes, it's like a really smart chess guy, kid who uses chess as a way. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And listen, I still had to do the work, but it was also important to recognize, like, that you're really fortunate and this is an opportunity, because I think also when you can recognize that, then you also will maximize that opportunity versus 4 years or 8 years down the road, you go, wow, that was a really important opportunity. I think when you can start to see it in the moment, then you can kind of squeeze the juice out of it and hopefully go, wow, this is hard work. And sometimes it's not fun, but it's an opportunity.
Were you able to see that? That's a very mature point of view for somebody who's in 11th grade. I mean, I don't know if I would have been able to not only A, see it, but then B, execute it. Or was this something that sort of the people around you, your mom or somebody was sort of whispering in your ear, or did it just hit you?
No, it's the opposite. Mm. If I call it the no safety net. So if you take somebody and you say, we're going to walk across this canyon and you got to balance on the tightrope and there's no safety net, you'd be surprised what your brain goes, oh, we have to make this.
Right.
Conversely, if you go, hey, you know, your safety net, could it be mom and dad, whatever, it's there, you'll fall.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think for me, it was just a matter of survival. And also I had some really important and positive adults, coaches, mm-hmm. principals, teachers, you know, what we call in Hawaii, aunties and uncles, that were there that I think gave me enough stability that it gave me a chance to kind of catch my breath to make the right decision.
That's good. What brought your family to St. Thomas? And you stayed there for quite a while and then to Florida. I know your dad passed away when you were five, but was there, were there relatives, extended relatives there or something, extended family?
Well, when I moved back in with my mom, she had married my stepfather, who was from Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And my biological father is from Trinidad. Mm-hmm. And my whole family from that side is from the Caribbean. So I think my mother always had an interesting fascination with the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. Clearly, with my dad and then my stepfather, I think they decided they didn't want to live in Puerto Rico at that time. So we moved very close. St. Thomas is, you know, all of 30 minutes in a puddle jumper, you know, right there. And so, and that's how we ended up there. And it was sort of unusual, but in a way it was very good for me because I could understand growing up on an island. I understood my dad's culture better. I understand my husband's culture. You know, I live in Hawaii. I live on an island. Mm. And so, I think it was difficult. It can be a hard place to grow up because it's something you have to survive. Like, don't have a kid by 19 or 20, but if you can, then, it can make you grounded in a way that maybe living on the mainland, not quite the same.
Right. Right. How did you balance? I mean, you were, a sophomore at Florida State when you were approached about modeling and started modeling. And then the inherent contradiction or paradox of the way you need to fuel your body for athletics, especially at the Division I level and then the pro level versus, you know, what you shouldn't fuel your body with as a model. Like, how did you balance that? Like, what would you eat and how tough was that?
I don't want to say I ignored the rules of fashion, but you know, you can't phone it in volleyball. And so after my freshman year, I moved to New York and started working. And then I went back to school for my sophomore season and literally for the next 3 years juggled both. But I was lucky because at that time there was a couple very successful models. There's a girl named Rachel Williams and another one, Ashley Richardson, very big girls, but kind of killing it. So they made a little bit of room.
Do you mean big in terms of like height and sort of broadness or
they were working a ton and they were big, strong girls. Like I was so jealous of Rachel Williams because she never had to even lift weights and she was pretty strong and big and probably close to 6'3", broad shoulders, big legs. But she was working, so there was room because the politics was swinging just far enough that way that they made room. And of course, I could barely do the shows because I can't fit into anything. You know, there were so many, there was quite a few limitations in fashion just because I didn't fit into anything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we made it work. And I sort of said I would just oblige my own code, which was I was an athlete. And so I would go home and scrape my makeup off at night and go to the gym and bang iron because I was also trying to stay somewhat in shape. So I didn't die the slow death when I got back to school to play ball because, again, you're not phoning that in. You know, good makeup artist isn't going to fix that. You're going to let your teammates down.
Yeah.
But yeah, of course, I was always hearing like, oh, you're so big. You're so muscular. You're so big. You're big. It's like, yeah, I'm big. And then I go to volleyball and everyone was trying to get bigger. So
yeah.
I think I just decided and went with it and stopped. And I didn't go bother to torment myself or, you know, smoke cigarettes and drink coffee.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, as an outsider looking in and as a man, it's like, I wouldn't classify you as big. I'd say, oh, well, okay, you're tall, but that's just a woman in great shape. Whereas if I look at a lot of those models, for me personally, there's nothing attractive about those models, nothing against them. I know they're doing what they got to do, but they're way too skinny and it's uncomfortable to look at. So it's sad that society kind of, if you're over 100 pounds and you've got, you know, more than 2% body fat, people put you in the big category. But that's society's problem, I think, not your problem, you know.
Well, and also, you know, you have to remember the notion of it's in some ways pretty simple. In a way, you are a hanger, right? So if you have this body that is very, very slender or skinny, it sort of all works in every direction. Right. Like, you know, so I think I understood what that was. And, you know, it sort of is what it is. I just decided, hey, I'm never going to fit into that just by being 6'3", period. I'm never going to fit. And I have an athletic build and I want to be as strong as I can. So I think you just, you know, it's like I tell my kids, we're trying to develop our own code to live by, whatever your code is, and honor that no matter what situation you're in. And so I thought, I really don't want to torment myself even at 18. So I just thought, this is me. And
yeah, it's a healthy way to live. I mean, I was, one of the things you said in an article talking about raising your kids, which is what my wife and I do, is like, you're not like Nazis about, I mean, you and your husband are world-class athletes, are in amazing shape. And obviously you have a regimen, but you're not psychotic about it. Like, we have a friend that would like, my son's best friend when they were kids and still are, but the parents would never let the kid have like sugar or cookies. And then the kid would come to our house and he'd, and you know, we'd have some package of Oreos. We weren't crazy, but you know, he'd devour like 15 Oreos where my kid's eating like 3 or 4. And it's like what comes across to me in learning more about you is sort of the word balance. You know, you're all about balance, which I think is really important when you're raising your kids. And then eventually you let that leash go. And then if you give them the right foundation, they kind of follow the right path when it comes to that. And I was really impressed with that.
Well, I think all human beings are hardwired to go against the grain and to want what they can't have. I think it's so inherently built into us, and it's such a great quality directed the right way. And for me, I just knew, and listen, my kids are very strong-willed. So you're always calibrating, like, how can I be effective and make it, and also trust them that they're going to make the right decision.
Yeah.
That's really, cause sometimes that takes time, right? Like sometimes that decision-making process, it actually takes a minute, and you have to have that weird faith that you're a good example and that they will arrive at it.
My wife is better at that than I am. She's like, you got to just let it breathe a little bit, take a step back. And I'm like, I tend to be more of a micromanager and worry. And has he got it figured out yet? And all of that.
it's really brutal and the most painful thing. Like me, I like to I like to get after it and get the solution and let's figure this out. And now parenting has been the one thing that has taught me, many things it's taught me, but one of them is like, you might have to wait. And especially when you're talking about like teenagers and things like that, like because if we remember when we were muddling through it, we got to muddle through it.
Yeah.
And they have to have that same space. And it is, it could be one of the most difficult things for me personally, because, you know, you're not objective about them, and you never want them to be hurt, and you never want them to make mistakes, but it's just not realistic.
Yeah. When you were playing a professional volleyball, or even, I mean, you know, at the college level, I know you're playing on a team, but if you're playing like a two person, arrangement, what are the challenges in finding the right partner? What are you looking for in the right partner? Not just in terms of physical ability, but mental makeup, emotional makeup. Like what? Because that to me seems to be one of those rare sports. I mean, I guess doubles and tennis is comparable, but like,
yeah.
What goes into that? And I guess a little bit of luck too in finding the right person. I guess it's like a relationship, right?
Well, exactly. And what really, it's interesting when you see one group can have amazing chemistry and you pull one out and put a different one in and it's not the right chemistry. So again, that's a really tailored and individual conversation where, it's the chemistry between the two and also the ability, you know, beach doubles is like two individual athletes actually playing on a team together. So in a way, everybody feels 100% accountable for everything, but then you have to have enough trust to rely on your partner. Like you're going to take that area. I'm going to trust you because I'm going to make decisions based on that.
Yeah.
So it's this in and out, but I think again, it's chemistry. Cause if you have one athlete, let's say who's super intense, like I'll give you an example. Randy Stoklas played with a guy named St. John Smith. Okay. So Randy is a physical specimen, big and strong and really talented. St. John was a mental giant and emotionally on the court. And so
elaborate on that for the listeners, meaning he just didn't get rattled. He was solid as a rock.
Yeah. And so what he was bringing to the court was not just, I mean, he's a great volleyball player. Don't get me wrong, but Randy was like a physical beast, right? You know, like just a freak of nature. And here you had St. John who would kind of create this space where if Randy made a mistake or a mistake happened, let's say, Randy needed it not probably to be his fault. He needed to be the guy so he could keep going. And St. John was like, yeah, knock yourself out. So here's an example of a team that worked so beautifully because St. John was very well aware of what Randy was bringing, and he understood how to create an environment for his teammate to be successful. And he had the capacity to be like, yeah, yeah, knock yourself out. Like you want to yell at me, whatever you got to do. And they won. And so I guess what it is too, is sometimes you give a teammate, maybe what they're bringing, you have to understand what that is.
Right. If you sort of put yourself in the back seat to that particular need of that person, it's better for the overall. And at the end of the day, you both win. If you let your ego sort of stay in check a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's true to life. Like in a marriage, you know, I always say sometimes I'm the flower, sometimes I'm the farmer, you know, it's true in business where you start to understand, well, this person is so good at this thing over here. And so how do I create the space for them that we can still execute so the collective can be successful. So I think it is no different than, I think, for example, if you're working with people, whether it's on a team sport, in a relationship, or in work, I do believe that your morals kind of have to be similar. So like if everyone feels like telling the truth is important, if you're in business, do you only value profit? Like, what are the things and then how you get there is all the different ways. Like, let's say you're in a business and you go, hey, the integrity of the product is more important than profit. If everyone is agreeing to that first, because they know in the long run, you'll probably be more successful. Then that's a starting point. If one person goes, hey, I want the quick dollar now. And the other person's like, I'm in it for the long run. You probably will reach a place where there'll be a problem. And I think that's the same in a team sport where it's like, hey, I need to look good.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. It's like, well, I'm kind of really interested in winning.
Yeah. Yeah. There aren't a lot of people that can kind of put their ego in check. It's almost like in your world of pro volleyball, one of you has to be not just an athlete, but a coach/psychologist a little bit too, to kind of figure out what the team needs to get to the gold medal, so to speak.
Every day, and if one of the teammates, one of the athletes is not, then they do have a coach that is understanding how to put everyone in the position for them to be successful. And that's a great coach to do anyway, but they understand like who needs a kick in the ass and who you need to go, hey, you're good, don't worry, you got it. Or just creating those environments. So if it isn't the athlete, it definitely, they have a coach that's sort of understanding how to get the pieces moving together, you know, for the greater good, so that one and one is three and not just two.
Just before we wrap up, are you still doing your alternate days workout where you do 3 days on land and I think 3 days in the pool?
Yes.
Explain that workout to people. It's a really, really cool workout.
Well, you know, this is one of the many things I appreciate about Laird. Again, he is really more of a creative person than a linear athlete. And I'm more like, how many reps, how many sets, how much time,
right,
kind of thing. And he's like, well, what if we try this? And so years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, he started doing an underwater pool training that was really like super simple. Like, you know, like dumbbells will go down, you jump as many times as you can until you run out of air, and then you've got to come up. Okay, great. So then it really evolved. Then there's like, you know, you can come up between each rep and get a breath. So what does that mean? You can do 50 reps. You can do 10 reps with heavy weight, whatever. And there was some kind of crash test dummies, myself and a couple of our friends. And he created an entire curriculum, all of us together, with about 40 moves. And the reason for the underwater pool training was it was Laird's off season. So April through November, he was looking for ways to stay interested in training. Imagine we've been at this a really long time. It can get really old.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So it's sort of like why people should read, because you can't keep telling the same stories or, you know, like you have to keep growing. Right. And
right.
So, the other beautiful thing about the water is low impact. So you can do ballistic training. So jumping and such without hammering your joints.
Yeah. I was a swimmer growing up, and, you know, I never had the kind of injuries that some of my friends did, you know, just as that was my sport, you know?
Well, and it's different than swimming because now we're adding resistance.
Oh, yeah.
As we get older, right, we want to stay explosive and you want to keep adding tension to your body, and not the bad kind, not like, you know, traffic, but like good
right.
tension.
Right.
So that, you know, your skeletal system stays strong. And the only way to do that is to put tension on it. And so here was a way, and then you're underwater. So in a way, secretly, you kind of feel like you're playing like a kid. You're also regulating your breath, which is, now that we've really gotten into training, the deeper I go, I would say that the breathing, and if anyone is listening at home, I would recommend a book called The Oxygen Advantage. And it discusses quite simply how all of us should be nose breathing, in and out through your nose. If you did a set of sprints, of course you want to recover through your mouth, but otherwise, we've only been breathing through our mouth for about 200 years, and children should be sleeping with their mouths closed. Your teeth don't oxidize. The way your muscles develop in your face and jaw are better. If you ask a boxing coach, if a guy comes out and he's mouth breathing, he tells his guy he's finished. So there's real science around that, which is, I could make it really simple. If you breathe in through your nose, your CO2 rises.
And I'm sorry, repeat that. If you breathe through your nose, your CO2 rises?
Rises, so it feels like pressure. So when you see somebody go down deep in a deep water breath hold, they'll breathe in and out rapidly through their mouth for two reasons. One, they'll either stack air in their lungs, and two, they're scrubbing their CO2, which is to get rid of it so it overrides the brain's impulse to want to breathe. So if you breathe in and out through your nose, if you're at work, now you've got, first of all, clean air filter through your nose. Secondly, if your CO2 starts to build in your system, which happens through these smaller openings, your nostrils, the oxygen that you're breathing in that gets to your bloodstream can only get into your cells and your muscle tissue by the presence of CO2. So if you see sometimes an older person, maybe they're a little bent over and they're belaboring breathing through their mouth. It's called over breathing under oxygenated. So really the oxygen advantage just gives you the straight science, because we do try to stay scientific also, like not just do everything freewheeling like woo, but like, hey, why are you doing this? And so I always say to people, listen, it's cheap, it's free, you can do it anywhere. And it's essential for your health. So, so the pool training to, sorry, I got derailed.
No, that's why. Honestly, what you just did in the last 2 minutes is why I do my podcast, because I just learned something that I don't know about nose breathing and CO2. And I think that's why these podcasts should exist, so people sort of are exposed to somebody like you who does something that 1% of the world probably does. And it's fascinating. So go on.
It's important because, again, my whole thing, Laird and I talk about it, is we have the luxury of doing all this kind of really fringe stuff. We get access to really, you know, smart people that teach us and tell us. But my whole thing is, how do we take everything and make it as inclusive as possible so that people who are working two jobs and have stressful lives and have no time, what are the simple little things they can do here and there to improve their overall well-being? And so nose breathing, and people will say, well, it's very hard, my one nostril, and all I can say is that the moisture will build, the nostrils will open up, they're connected to the lungs, so that moisture builds, and if I could say to them, when you breathe in, try to deep into the pelvis first, not into the chest. So you pull it way down in, almost like stick your stomach out when you breathe in through your nose. And then you can use your spine like a hydraulic to pull this sort of imaginary ball of air up and beyond the chest. And the other great thing is if they exhale, let's say they do it for 2 minutes and their exhales are at least 7 seconds through the nose. Then what they can do, and you can do this with your children, is it's called down-regulating, or going into your parasympathetic system, or going into your relaxed side. So think about when people sigh. They go, oh, right? They don't realize that they're actually trying to down-regulate. They're trying to relax. And so if people can nose breathe in and out, and their exhales can become about 7 seconds, involuntarily, without trying, without thinking about it, you'll put your body into a relaxed state. So very good if you're feeling ramped up, if you feel like you want to choke someone's neck, if you're trying to these are really healthy ways to get your system.
Right.
But I there's, you know, there's a reason that breathing is so old. You know, I always joke about like organic and bone broth. I go, oh, everything so modern is really just what we used to do naturally in our lives.
And it's just sort of maybe repackaged a little bit. Is there, as we wrap up here, this XPT, is that a program that you guys are doing? Is there some places that people can go to online or books or whatever you guys got that turn people onto this stuff? Tell them about it.
XPT, life.com was born out of, our organic lifestyle. So it has like the pool training. It talks about heat and ice. For those people, if you could handle it, depending on where you live, if you could end every shower 30 seconds with cold water, the health benefits of that are through the roof. If people want to look that up, just hormone regulation, moods, things like that, because we do ice, but I know that's hard to do. And then there is the breathing, and we actually are going to be coming out with breathing apps that either can get you ready for movement or get you calmed down, all kinds of things. And
great.
You know, our whole thing is, if we could figure out ways to take care of ourselves, it just makes navigating everything else, relationships and work.
Oh, yeah.
And everything's better. But I also realize how stacked up people's lives are. And so the book is Patrick McCune. He's an Irish gentleman. And his book is called The Oxygen Advantage. It's not light reading, I'm not going to lie. So I actually did a podcast with him called The Truth Barrel. He was the guest. If they just want to listen to it, they can.
Okay.
I'm trying to think what other – there's so many good books, but I think right now at the moment that one is really the best one.
Great. And go to xptlife.com, and a lot of this will be there. I can't thank you enough. I was really excited to talk to you because, like I said, I've been watching on TV doing your thing for a long time, and your husband. And just as I got more into learning about you guys, it's just a great, great way you guys live and a great approach to life. So I can't thank you enough for being on, and you know, hope to have you back again sometime soon.
Well, thank you, and good luck with your podcast. And I do think it's important that, you know, we all can share and keep learning. And I think that's like what naturally we're supposed to do.
Yeah, there's only two things I want my podcast to do. One is to expose people to people that they don't know who I think they should know, or expose people to people like yourself who are very well known and celebrities and have a high profile, but learn more about them, what makes them tick, and what got them to where they are, because I think we ought to be more inclusive of things that we don't know, as opposed to staying in our own little box, you know? So if one of those two things can happen in every episode, then I'm happy. So this has been great. And I'm going to try I'm going to definitely take a look at this book, because I'm fascinated by the idea of sort of breathing the right way, you know?
Health benefits as far as like alkalining your system, just some other things. It can be pretty powerful.
Yeah, no, it sounds really important. Thanks again. This is Gabby Reese, and please come back anytime when you got other stuff going on, but it was really great having you on. Thank you.
Aloha.
All right, that was Gabby Reese. I don't know, man. I saw some of her workouts online, and it is intense. I was exhausted just hearing about them. Anyway, hope you enjoyed it. She was great, and hope you can make it out to see me on the road March 23rd and 24th at Bananas Comedy Club in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, and March 28th to the 31st at the House of Comedy in Bloomington, Minnesota. And appreciate the comments and the kind words. If you haven't done so, please head over to iTunes and drop a comment. See you next week, everybody.